Graphic Audio. A movie in your mind.
Graphic Audio presents Stephen L. Kent, Rogue Clone, narrated by Ken Jackson, with performances by Christopher Sheeran, David Coyne, Joe Brack, Tim Pabon, Eric Messner, Michael John Casey, Elliot Dash, Dylan Lynch, Colleen Delaney, Christopher Graybill, Tony Nam, Danny Gavigan, Patrick Bussing, Drew Copus, Michael Glenn, Stephen Carpenter, James Lewis, Richard Rowan, Johan Detweiler, Daniel Sontag, Bradley Smith, Casey Jones. Book 7, The Clone Redemption. Earth date, November 18, AD 2517. Location, planet A361F. Galactic position, solar system A361. Astronomic location, Bodas galaxy. Yamashiro Yoshi, admiral of the Japanese fleet, stood behind a table that had been draped with a white tablecloth. On the table sat a ceramic bottle, an ivory-glazed ceramic cylinder 8 inches tall and 3 inches wide, covered with hand-painted kanji. Beside the bottle sat a row of 13 thimbles. The seals called them thimbles because they held no more liquor than you could fit in a thimble. The Japanese called them ochoko. The ochoko matched the bottle, ivory-colored glaze and covered with kanji symbols. Yamashiro filled each of the ochoko with sake.
Come forward and take your ochoko.
The 12 seals stepped forward and took a cup. He took the 13th cup.
Drink!
Once the seals had drained their sake, Yamashiro nodded to them and then left the landing bay of the battleship Onoda, his officers in tow. Once they were gone, Ilyich gathered his seals beside the transport that would launch them on their mission. The transport would not take them down to the planet, but if everything went well, it would bring them back to the ship. Capalilia and Humble looked at each other, confused.
You did know that was a traditional kamikaze farewell.
Yeah, I know. Only we're coming back.
Maybe. We might think we're coming back, but Yamashiro doesn't.
The rear hatch of the transport ground open, and the seals shuffled in. As Ilyich passed, Humble spoke to his commanding officer.
Master Chief, do you think we're coming back?
As long as the fleet doesn't leave us behind.
The transport had been flying for about 20 minutes when Ilyich turned to address his seals.
Board your caskets.
The caskets were stealth infiltration pods, or SIPs. Coffin-sized people flyers designed to evade all known forms of detection. 6 feet long and 3 feet wide, SIPs could travel millions of miles in an hour. They scanned for radar, sonar, and laser detection and camouflaged their own footprint. They did not have guns or steering controls. SEALs did not pilot their caskets. They went along for the ride. Seemingly designed to make passengers uncomfortable, the cargo pit of the SIP lacked so much as a shred of padding, had no lights, and no communications gear. The SIP was designed for 10-minute flights and nothing longer. A team of technicians opened the pods, and the SEALs climbed into their caskets without hesitation. Once the technicians closed the pod doors, dry gel oozed in around the seals to protect them against the stresses of extreme acceleration and deceleration. Working as quickly as they could, technicians, dressed in soft-shelled armor, lifted the SIPs into place. The launching device had a revolving carriage with chambers for 12 caskets that the techs loaded like bullets. The pilot purged the air from the kettle, then he shut off the engines and all of the lights as he opened the rear hatch. The device fired the pods into space. For the duration of their flight, the SEALs heard nothing as they streaked through space. Barely larger than old-fashioned spacesuits, the pods carried their cargo 500,000 miles in a matter of seconds. All 12 pods landed within a 40-foot radius, Their cargo bay doors opened, and the seals emerged. Ilyich and his team knew what to expect. This planet was known as A361F, as it was the sixth planet from the star labeled A361. A361F had an unbreathable atmosphere, a toxic cocktail of nitrogen, carbon monoxide, and methane. Because it was so far from the sun, a foot-thick layer of poisonous frost covered its surface. Ilyich thought the planet looked a lot like Earth's moon might have looked had it been frozen under ice. Nothing had color. The ground was gray. The sky was black. The seals did not waste time chatting about the dreary surroundings. In the hours before the mission began, remote surveillance technicians had used satellite drones to map the planet. Designed for military use, the satellites were not equipped to take air samples from space. They tested for radiation, located non-natural structures, recorded ground movement, and searched for possible targets. On this planet, the satellites found only one point of interest, an abandoned building complex. Looking at the satellite reports, Yamashiro's intelligence officers said that complex was inactive, possibly an abandoned fort or a fueling station for space travelers. They had no way of knowing if it belonged to the Avatari, the aliens who had created such havoc upon the Milky Way. The author of the report did speculate that the enormous cylindrical structures along one face of the complex might be storage silos, suggesting that the facility might have been used as a fuel refinery. The SEALs divided into 3 4-man reconnaissance teams. Ilyich led his team toward the complex itself. If the building had had walls, doors, or windows, the Master Chief and his men would have searched from outside, looking for guards or security equipment. No doors, no walls, no roof. More than anything else, the place was a tangle of pipes and chambers. Inch-thick frost had formed on the structure, creating gray camouflage over the jet-black metallic surfaces below. The building stood no more than 50 feet tall, built on an open-faced foundation. Using the thermal lenses in his visor, Ilyich scanned the area for heat signatures. He found nothing. Either the structure was out of use, or the material flowing through the pipes was of a type that could not be frozen. Ilyich and his team looked for signs of the Avatari. They searched the platform for doors and compartments, using the sonar and X-ray equipment in their helmets. Then they used the enhanced handheld equipment that they had brought with them. The pipes and chambers were hollow. The foundation and the ground around it were solid. Petty Officer Andrew Call aimed a torch at a patch of frost on a pipe that was so big around he could have stood in it. The gray layer turned to steam under the heat and quickly evaporated.
Do you want me to cut the pipe open?
Didn't you say the pipe is empty?
As far as I can tell.
What's the point in cutting it open?
It will give us a chance to see what it's made of. I've never seen anything like this. It X-rays easily, but I can't find wires or circuits, none of the components you expect to find inside a machine. Whatever passes for power around here, it's not electricity-based.
Hold off. For now, let's just figure out what we're dealing with.
Ilyich stood at the edge of the foundation, tracing the shapes of the pipes that formed the structure. The building had an organic, random feeling. So much frost covered the pipes that they looked like an ice sculpture, but only a thin layer of powdery frost had formed on the foundation. Looking for footprints in that powder, Ilyich thought that centuries might have passed since the aliens had last visited the facility.
Do you think this belongs to the same aliens that invaded us?
I'm sure of it.
This place is weird. I've never seen anything like it.
It looks like a refinery.
Yeah, an abandoned refinery. That makes sense, but it's been out of service for a long, long time.
Chief Petty Officer Humble joined the conversation.
So what? It's a refinery?
What kind of ships did the aliens fly when they attacked our planets?
They didn't have ships.
You don't need remote fuel depots once you stop flying ships.
Beside the building, a row of 27 identical cylindrical structures rose out of the ground. They stood 970 feet tall. They had the same hyperbolic shape as the cooling towers of nuclear power facilities, only turned upside down. The structures were wider at the top than at the base. While Ilyich and his men surveyed the building, Chief Petty Officer Humble's team studied the towers. Using equipment in his helmet, Humble measured the nearest tower, 223 feet wide at the base and 352 feet wide at the top.
You got anything?
Yeah, it's like these things are made of eggshells. Once you get through all the ice, the walls are a 20th of an inch thick. I'm surprised they don't collapse under the weight of the ice.
Can you see inside?
Yeah, they x-ray right up. They're empty and hollow all the way down.
All the way down?
If you think this thing is tall, you should see how far down it goes.
How far?
Over a mile.
Do you think it's a silo?
That's my best guess, but it's empty.
Do we know if these pipes are made of the same stuff?
They aren't as thin as eggshells. It looks like this place was abandoned a long, long time ago. Some of the ice on these pipes is over 100,000 years old.
That was when Ilyich saw the light. All of the seals saw it. A dull sun shone in the distance, but far brighter light now shone directly above them. Having been briefed about the invasion of their own galaxy, the seals knew what that light meant. The aliens had arrived.
Looks like the home team knows we're here.
A few yards away, Call left his x-ray camera beside a pipe and pulled out his gun. Three of the seals carried pistols, six carried M27s, three carried sniper rifles. All of their weapons were loaded with custom-made rounds, bullets designed to explode like miniature grenades.
Okay, we've trained for this. Take your positions. Maybe we'll get lucky.
The only thing that mattered now was reporting what little they had learned before the aliens sleeved the planet. The light in the sky, dubbed by scientists as an ion curtain, would quickly enclose the planet, ending all transmissions. Once it spread over the platform, the seals would be cut off.
The atmosphere is toxic, mostly nitrogen and carbon monoxide. The building appears to be a refinery. We think it is out of use, but cannot be sure. It's covered with ice. The ice on the pipes is 100,000 years old. I checked the samples myself.
The pilot of the transport interrupted Ilyich's message.
Find a safe position. I'm coming to get you.
Negative. Do not attempt to retrieve us.
Yamashiro himself was the next to break in.
Master Chief, have one of your men fire at the cylinders.
Humble, fire a burst at one of the silos.
The bullets blew away the frost, but they did not scratch the structure.
Bulletproof.
Ilyich led his men into the structure. Instead of beams, walls, and doorways, the building had pipes and empty spaces. Ilyich looked for elevators or ladders that would lead to the top of the structure. He found nothing. Ilyich reached the far side of the building at the same moment as the three other men in his squad.
Have you seen defenders?
On the frozen plain, not far from the building, a 10-foot-tall globe glowed even more bright than the light around it. It stood out like a platinum sphere in a bed of well-polished silver. As he turned to examine the globe, the tent shields in Ilyich's visor deployed to protect his eyes. He saw the crystal white sphere and the dirty brown gas that leaked from its base. Ilyich also saw the aliens inside the globe, 10-foot-tall, translucent yellow shadows with arms and legs, but no facial features except grapefruit-sized chrome-silver eyes. The apparitions stepped out of the sphere, and the seals opened fire. Their bullets passed through the aliens, the same way they passed through light or air. They hit nothing and did not explode. Capalilia ran along the side of the building. He came within a few feet of the creatures and fired his weapon. His bullets passed through them as if they were ghosts. He threw a grenade. It did nothing. One of the creatures swung its chrome-barreled rifle at Capalilia. Capalilia's body did not explode. No blood splashed from the wound. He simply fell backward. Mercifully, he was dead before he hit the ground. As Ilyich watched, the aliens' bodies slowly solidified.
Aim for their rifles.
Ilyich expected the aliens to return fire, but they didn't. They stood outside the building, their glowing, translucent hides cooling to the color of honey, and they waited. For just an instant, Ilyich considered stopping the countdown, but he decided against it. He read the timer in his visor. In 3 minutes and 26 seconds, the field resonance engines and the 12 stealth infiltration pods would overcharge and explode. Once overcharged, the field resonance engines inside the pods would become unstable. They'd be like dams, holding back an endless flow of energy. In 3 minutes and 20 seconds, the pods would use that energy to self-destruct, taking the entire planet with them.
Looks like they don't want to come in after us.
One of the aliens walked to the edge of the building and stopped. Dozens of bullets passed through its body and head without leaving a trace. Several shots hit its weapon.
Transport, you there?
Three of the aliens walked toward the building. The seals hit the aliens with grenades and bullets and rockets, but their attacks meant nothing.
You there? I hope they're getting this.
The alien either wouldn't or couldn't enter the building. It did not fire its weapon at the SEALs. Having read the reports and seen the video feeds, Ilyich knew the bolts these aliens fired bored through brick, metal, wood, and men alike. Humble's bullets had not hurt the silo, but this creature's bolts would probably pierce it. Ilyich checked the time. 1:48.
It's not coming after us.
All five of the aliens gathered at the edge of the building. They did not speak to each other. Their skins still glowed the color of honey, but dark scales had begun to form.
Maybe it has orders not to hurt the building.
So we have a standoff.
For another 1.5 minutes.
You're charging the caskets.
87 seconds and counting.
I knew I should have read my death poem.
Location, Terrano. Galactic position, Scutum Crux Arm. Astronomic location, Milky Way. They say God created the plants on the 3rd day, the animals on the 5th, and man on the 6th. What God did in 3 days, the aliens undid in less than 1.5 minutes. It took the bastards 83 seconds to kill everything that walked the surface of Terrano, right down to the microbes. I was one of the 1,037 people who survived the attack on the once grand planet of Terrano. We survived because we hid in a tunnel that ran under a lake. By far, the vast majority of the survivors were clones, members of Scutum Crux Fleet's Corps of Engineers. There was an even 1,000 of them. I was one of 2 Marines who survived. The other survivors included Ava Gardner, the woman I had once loved, and the man who had replaced me as her lover. My pilot, Lieutenant Christian Nobles, was the other Marine. Ray Freeman, the mercenary, homicidal humanitarian who busted me out of jail in time to save me from getting cooked with everybody else, survived as well. The 32 other lottery winners were members of the local militia. In the moments before the aliens attacked, the local militia raided the tunnel, hoping to haul me back to prison. They entered with hundreds of men, but only 32 had traveled far enough into the tunnel to survive the heat. They attacked our sanctuary moments before the Avatari performed their pyrotechnic magic, raising the surface temperature of Terrano to 9,000 degrees. The temperature outside the tunnel spiked 8,927 degrees and remained at 9,000 degrees for precisely 83 seconds, then dropped back to normal almost as quickly. Hiding behind a thick steel door in the depths of a tunnel, my engineers and I rode out the attack unharmed. When we opened the doors, just about everyone on the planet had been killed and cremated, and their dust was carried on the largely carbon dioxide winds. Just behind the door, we found 32 militiamen cowering in the dark. They were good to go except for burst eardrums, a few broken bones, and the shock of knowing that everything and everyone they loved had been burned. As I wandered toward the entrance of the tunnel, the corpses became more badly burned. 100 feet from daylight, the bodies were papery ash that turned to dust at the slightest touch. I walked to the mouth of the tunnel, taking in the lake, the sky, and the distant ruins of Norristown. From where I stood, Lake Norris looked as big as an ocean, so far across that I would not be able to see its farthest shores, even on a clear day. On this day, the air around me was the color of tea, and clouds of smoke and ash filled the sky. Incinerating 5 million people and all their belongings puts a lot of dust in the wind.
General Harris, are you there?
The call came from Captain Don Cutter, commander of the EMN Churchill. EMN stood for Enlisted Man's Navy. My Navy.
General Harris, are you there?
Harris here.
This was the first outside communication I'd received since entering the tunnel.
What's the situation, sir?
The worst.
How many survivors?
1,000 and change. How do things look up there?
The Unified sent a spy ship into the area.
How are you able to spot it?
The Unified Authority, the Earth-based empire that created me and my fellow clones, used modified cruisers for surveillance and reconnaissance. The spy ships were fast, small, and equipped with cloaking technology that rendered them utterly invisible.
We parked in the debris and turned off our lights. They didn't know we were here.
Didn't they cloak?
They cloaked all right. But they dropped their skirts when they launched their eye.
Come again?
They had to lower their shields to deploy their satellite. Weapons picked up the energy fluctuation.
Nice work.
Thank you, sir. Do you want us to destroy the eye?
Hell no. Leave it alone, Captain. Having an enemy satellite in place might come in handy.
Terrano was in the Scutum Crux Arm, the outermost arm of the Milky Way. Earth was located in the Orion Arm, clear across the galaxy. The only way for the Unifieds to pull any data from that satellite would be by sending their spy ship back to retrieve it. When their spy ship returned, we would give her a proper reception. The spy ship sneaked out of the anomaly the way mice sneak out of their holes, quickly, carefully, silently. With her stealth generator, the spy ship was invisible to our equipment. Only the anomaly showed on the readouts. The spy ship was small and unarmed, the naval equivalent of a hummingbird. She had the ability to slip in behind enemy lines and listen to our communications, track our movements, and watch our production without threat of detection. But this ship had been detected. We saw where she broadcasted into our space, and we knew her final destination. It didn't matter that we lost track of the ship as she traveled the 14 million miles from the anomaly to the satellite, because we knew precisely where she would end her journey. She was the mouse in the night. We were the cat. When she materialized beside the satellite, we would pounce. The satellite was smaller than a golf ball and armed with a camera so powerful that it could pick out a single grain of sand in an open desert. The satellite's unblinking eye undoubtedly recorded us as we pulled our shuttle out of the tunnel and launched into space. It must have spotted us setting our trap as well. But the crew of the spy ship would have no access to those data until they retrieved the satellite.
Anything?
Nothing yet, sir.
Freeman and I watched the scene on a small video screen as we waited inside the kettle of a transport. The screen showed a panoramic view of open space. Terranos spun in a corner of the screen, its oceans still blue, but hidden behind a global cloud of smoke and ash.
You're still on our side, right?
Freeman was a human sphinx. He answered questions only when he felt like answering. Generally, he ignored them. He was a mercenary, but money did not determine his loyalty.
Why help us? Why not the Unifieds?
I'm not taking sides.
The hell you're not. We're about to attack a Unified Authority boat. If you don't care who wins, you don't belong on this ride.
I don't care about sides. Just saving lives. That's it. It's not about loyalty. The only planet the Unifieds care about is Earth. You're out to save what's left of the galaxy. What's left of the galaxy.
Good enough for me.
Satisfied that I could trust Freeman for now, I turned my attention to the mission at hand.
Cutter, are the traps in position?
Yes, sir.
Five transports floated within a few hundred yards of the satellite. They were not debris from the graveyard of ships, but fully functional birds Cutter had placed himself. One of the transports carried a team of engineers. Freeman and I sat in the kettle of the second. The others sat facing away from the satellite, their rear hatches open, their kettles carefully packed with explosives. When the spy ship lowered her shields, we would use these transports like old-fashioned cannons.
How long has it been since you detected the anomaly?
52 minutes, sir.
Maybe they know we're here.
Not likely.
I looked back at the video screen and saw nothing but empty space. The satellite was so small that it did not even appear on my screen. A little bubble of light represented the area around it.
Mars, are your men ready?
Mars, Lieutenant Scott Mars, ran my corps of Navy engineers. I would have preferred using a demolitions team on this mission, but Mars's men were handy with explosives.
Yes, sir. You stop the ship, sir, and we'll kick her doors in.
Minimal damage.
You said you wanted a hole.
Right.
Well, if you know a way to put a hole in a ship without doing damage...
I take your point.
We'll keep the damage to a minimum, sir.
It's a go.
Nothing had changed on my screen. The ash-choked atmosphere of Terrano still showed in one corner of the screen. Our transports still hid at the edge of the debris. I did not see the spy ship. Of course I didn't see her. Not yet, at least. But the spy ship must have been in place beside the satellite, and her crew must have lowered her shields, or Cutter would not have sent that message. His sensors detected energy fluctuations. Cutter detonated the bombs in the three open transports, firing a barrage of bearings and shrapnel at the invisible target. The explosions flashed and vanished on my video screen. The spy ship took the beating and survived. Her stealth generators failed, and she came into view. Air and flames leaked from the small holes in her hull, and a large outer panel had been ripped from her bow, all cosmetic damage that would nonetheless prove fatal for her crew. The ship was shaped like the head of a gigantic spear, 50 feet wide at her stern and 200 feet long. Tiny electrical eruptions burst across her cylindrical hull.
We're up.
We climbed onto the sled, Freeman driving. We hovered down the ramp at the rear of the transport, traveling at the sled's top speed of 10 miles per hour. Ahead of us, The team of engineers assigned to open the ship approached the hull on a sled as well. They drifted along the fuselage, finally stopping behind the darkened maw of the bridge. They worked quickly, using a laser saw to slice a 5-foot hole into the side of the ship.
Now we know how we're going to get in.
Freeman puttered our sled toward the hole. As we drew nearer, the spy ship no longer looked so remarkably small. She was 3 stories tall. For his purposes, Freeman only needed to salvage a specific communications computer, but I wanted the entire ship. My goals were more military-minded. Under normal circumstances, Freeman and I would have used particle beam weapons when entering a disabled ship. This time, we brought flechette-firing S9 stealth pistols. He was concerned about a communications computer. I worried about everything else. Using a magnetic clamp, Freeman anchored our sled to the hull of the ship, and I launched myself in through the door. Emergency lights flashed along the ceiling of the mostly darkened main corridor. This was the spine of the ship, a hall that led from the bridge to the galley. When the hull of a capital ship is punctured, emergency bulkheads slide into place to prevent the depressurization from shooting sailors into space. In theory, the bulkheads created pressurized safety compartments in which sailors could wait for the atmospheric pressure to stabilize. In practice, the bulkheads created death chambers. If the emergency bulkheads were still in place, we might find crew members trapped in the various compartments. If they had already retracted, we might run into armed sailors hoping for a little revenge. Using night for day vision, I looked toward the bridge. Cruisers don't really have bridges, they have oversized cockpits. I saw no signs of life. I looked toward the aft of the ship.
The emergency doors have retracted.
The ship would need extensive repairs. We'd miscalculated the damage when we set the trap, and we did not have a working shipyard for making repairs. Freeman drew his pistol as he entered the ship.
Any signs of life?
Not on this deck.
There were a couple of bodies, men iced up like statues. The smaller debris must have flushed out through the holes. Looking down the hall, I saw empty floors and battered walls.
Do you have any idea where they stowed your computer?
Second deck.
Are we looking for anything in particular?
It might be attached to a broadcast apparatus.
A broadcast computer? You're looking for a specking broadcast computer?
Not the main broadcast engine. This will be attached to a small secondary broadcast engine.
We might have knocked out the spy ship's air and lights, but her gravity generator still worked. We were standing, not floating above the floor.
This wreck may be beyond repair.
I had the same fear. Deployed properly, a ship like this could turn the course of a war. I was just about to tell Lieutenant Mars to send over some engineers when I glimpsed the glow just beyond the next bulkhead.
There's a live one.
Always aware of everything around him, Freeman held his S9 out as he moved to cover.
Shielded armor.
The bastard walked right up the hall, showing no fear at all. He might have been a Marine or sailor, but he was wearing the shielded combat armor of a Unified Authority Marine, the new shielded armor that the Unified Authority created after expelling us clones from its military. Knowing that we had no weapons that could penetrate his ethereal electromagnetic coat, the cocky son of a bitch walked right up to the hole we had created as an entrance and casually surveyed the area. I hid behind a storage locker. Freeman knelt beside a desk. The man did not carry a gun. The shielding prevented him from holding external weapons. That did not leave him unarmed. A flechette-firing tube ran along the top of his right sleeve.
Get ready to run. I'm going to hit him with a grenade.
The shrapnel would not penetrate his shielding, but the percussion from the blast would still knock him on his ass. I made ready to throw my grenade.
You want this ship in one piece?
If you have a better idea.
Freeman pulled a thumb-sized device from his ammunition belt and slid it onto the desk.
Look at the floor. Don't look up.
I had just enough time to avert my eyes before his device lit the area so brightly that the floor looked bleached beneath my knee. The man in the marine armor pivoted around and reached out with both hands like a drunk groping down a dark alley. We ran down the corridor, hugging the walls in case the blinded marine tried to shoot us. A short way down the corridor, we found stairs leading to the lower decks. We started down.
Stall him.
Stall him?
Keep him busy while I look for the computer.
Got any suggestions about how to keep him busy without getting myself killed?
Call out if you get trapped.
Freeman vanished down the stairs. The glare died out at the other end of the corridor. I aimed my S9. Needing to grab his attention, I stepped into the open, catching the silly bastard by surprise. I fired 3 shots that hit him square in the face, then jumped down the first flight of stairs and waited for him to chase me. Mission accomplished. The Marine came after me. But when he reached the top of the stairs, he stopped. I waited for the bastard to start down the stairs. When he didn't, I cautiously climbed back up to see what had happened. Hoping to ambush me, the stupid son of a bitch had waited in an open hatch at the top of the stairs. I spotted him easily enough. The light from his shielded armor glowed like a moon.
So much for the element of surprise, asshole.
I waited for him as he waited for me. I had my pistol out and aimed. When he peered out of the doorway to look for me, I shot him in the face. It was a moral victory. Caught off guard, the Marine tried to spring up, lost his footing, and fell on his ass. He climbed off the floor and returned fire. But by that time, of course, I had jumped back down the stairs. Up at the top of the stairs, the glow of his shields diluted the darkness. The squirrely Marine was in no rush to chase me. He moved cautiously, as if he thought I could actually hurt him. He aimed down the stairs. I waited until he reached the landing by the second deck. Then I drilled several shots into him. The flechettes did no damage, but they kept the guy on my tail.
Have you found your computer yet?
You in trouble?
No, I'm good. I'm having a great time keeping our friend off the second deck.
Freeman did not respond.
I think I'll take my new friend for a tour of the bottom deck.
Trying not to offer myself as a target, I spun and fired a couple of shots to let the bastard know which way I was going. Having survived being shot in the face multiple times, the Marine had come to realize that I could not harm him. Now he stormed the hall like a bull in a china shop, firing badly aimed flechettes that skimmed the walls and the ceiling. The hall before me was long and straight, with no place for me to hide. If the Marine had had better training, he would have drilled those flechettes into my back.
How are you doing?
You okay?
Peachy.
The first of the landing bays was just a few yards up the corridor. The door slid open, revealing 10,000 square feet of empty hangar floor without paper, furniture, or bodies. Everything had been sucked out through the jagged 30-foot wound in the far wall. The area was full of shadows, but my night-for-day lenses let me see through the darkness. There was no other way out than the hatch I had just used, so I hid in a corner, squeezed in as best I could, and hoped I could sneak out of the dead end. The glow of shielded armor spilled in. Seconds passed. Then the bastard walked into the landing bay without so much as a glance to the side, marching right past me. He walked straight to the far wall and examined the gaping hole that looked like a mural of open space. I waited a second, then dashed toward the hatch. This time, his flechettes barely missed me.
Any luck finding your computer?
Yes, these guys were at Olympus Cree.
Olympus Cree was another planet that the Avatari had burned.
Sounds like they have a disaster fetish.
You safe?
I have an angry Unified Authority Marine in shielded combat armor chasing me down a dead end.
Freeman did not say anything. He knew the situation.
I've got things under control.
The next landing bay was almost right across the hall. I ran to the hatch, but it did not open. The bastard's aim kept improving. I streaked down the hall in a balls-out race. Cocky or not, this guy would win the fight if the next hatch did not open. Hell, he might get lucky even if it did. I hurled myself at the hatch, and the door slid open. I ran toward the transport that sat with its hatch open. I entered the kettle and hit the button to close the doors at the rear of the ship. Then I climbed the ladder that led to the cockpit. As I reached the top, I looked back over my shoulder. I could not see the doors at the bottom of the ramp, but I knew how slowly they moved. The man in the armor made it through the doors and up the ramp. I could not see him, but I saw the glow that his shields cast on the wall as he strolled up the ramp. I slipped from the ladder to the catwalk that led to the cockpit. Then I knelt low against the metal walkway and watched the bastard as he reached the top of the ramp.
I have the computer. Harris, where are you?
I'm fine.
What is the situation?
I'm in a transport in the third landing bay.
Where's the Marine?
You call this shithead a Marine? I'll tell you what, the Unifieds are scraping the bottom of the barrel. The only thing this guy's trained for is KP duty or maybe scrubbing the head.
Harris, hang on. I'm on my way.
Take your time, Ray. There's no rush.
The UA Marine either used heat vision or possibly radar. One way or another, he spotted me on the catwalk. Tracking the guy with my heat vision, I sat with my S9 pistol ready and watched as the poor bastard wasted his endless supply of flechettes.
You can't hit me, asshole. Not from down there.
He didn't hear me. I was talking to myself. Down on the deck, the guy kept firing flechettes in my direction. I switched from interlink to external speaker.
Hey! Shit for brains! You're wasting ammunition!
Expect!
Have it your way! You've been chasing me for about 10 minutes now. That leaves you with about half an hour before the battery powering your shield runs out.
When he came to his senses, the bastard would realize that he had two choices. He could climb the ladder to come after me, or he could open the rear hatch and escape. Either way, he would need to lower his shields. The shields would prevent him from wrapping his hands around the ladder, and they would short out the circuits if he tried to work the hatch. Using heat vision lenses, I watched as he worked out his options. After a minute or two, he started toward the ladder. The bastard must have known that his shields would repulse anything he touched, but he had to make sure. I moved toward the edge of the catwalk on the off chance he was stupid enough to lower the shields and start climbing. He stood at the base of the ladder and weighed his options. Apparently rejecting the ladder as an option, he paced back and forth across the floor of the cargo hold. He had figured out an indisputable truth. He could not exit the transport without opening the rear hatch. There were only two mechanisms for opening that hatch. One was up in the cockpit. One was in the kettle. He walked to the panel at the far end of the kettle. At that point, I needed to do more than track heat signatures. I needed to watch the bastard. Needing to catch him the moment he lowered his shields, I crawled to the edge of the catwalk and stared down at him. He stood a foot from the panel with his back to me, staring at the button. He stayed that way for several seconds, then spun. His shots were wild, but close enough. Now we were both in trouble. He could not hit that button without lowering his shields, but I could not watch him without placing myself in his line of fire. Realizing my trap was not as bulletproof as I had surmised, I ducked back behind the ledge and used my heat vision lenses to watch as his hand edged toward the button. He reached for the button and stopped. I raised myself with my elbows. In the brief glimpse I got, I saw him there, standing 2 feet from the button, his right arm pointing up toward me and his left probing toward the button. Like him, I was using heat vision tracking. I switched to tactical view, the unenhanced view we used on the battlefield. He began shooting faster. The shots cut a line above me, some pinging off the side of the catwalk. And then he made his move. He lowered his shields, and the cabin went dark. The moment the cabin went dark, I rolled to my side. Even before my night day lenses showed me the cabin floor, I instinctively knew I had hit the target. The bastard lay on the cold steel deck, rolling and writhing like a fish on a line. Blood leaked out of his armor at the shoulder and gut. The two shots that hit him in the shoulder probably hurt more than the one in the gut, but it was the latter that would kill him. I'd seen too many men kill the enemy who had dealt them the fatal blow, so I waited on the catwalk and watched as the poor bastard bled to death. The enlisted man's empire had men and ships and a recently rebuilt broadcast network. What we did not have were the ghosts. We needed the computer from the spy ship to reach the Unified Authority's top-secret ghosts. Okay, well, I called them ghosts. In truth, they were virtual reproductions of William Sweetwater and Arthur Breeze, the two dead scientists who had helped thwart the Avatari's first invasion. Shortly before they died, the real Sweetwater and Breeze allowed a team of medical technicians to scan their brains and take samples of their DNA. Somewhere along the line, the Unifieds used the scans and samples to recreate the scientists inside a computer. They used the DNA to construct virtual models of their bodies that were realistic enough to make their scanned brainwaves feel right at home.
That's it? I played hide-and-seek with a guy in shielded armor for that?
The computer was the size of a man's wallet, and most of it was screen.
Where's the broadcast engine?
Broken.
Broken? So we're out of business.
The computer works. I just need to connect it to a broadcast engine before we can reach Sweetwater and Breeze.
Did you have one in mind?
The EME Broadcast Network.
The enlisted man's empire had a broadcast network. It was the backbone of the empire. Friend or foe, it didn't matter. I was not about to give a mercenary access to the network.
You're out of luck, Ray. I won't give you that access.
You're going to need Sweetwater and Breeze if you're planning to evacuate planets.
I'm not giving you our broadcast codes.
Freeman's expression did not change. He did not smile, or snarl, or do anything threatening.
Are you saying that the enlisted man's empire is going to abandon its planets and citizens?
I weighed all of the possibilities in my mind.
We won't have much of an empire if we let everybody die.
The compromise was obvious. Freeman probably expected it from the start.
The computer stays with me. When we need to contact Sweetwater, I control the computer, and you control the broadcast access.
I can live with that.
Freeman and I now sat side by side in a conference room on the Churchill. Freeman's little communications computer, now jacked into the ship's communications network, sat on the table between us. Freeman toyed with the links going to his computer.
What time is it?
0100 STC.
They're asleep.
As nothing more than sophisticated computer animations, Sweetwater and Breeze should have been able to work around the clock. But they had been programmed to eat, sleep, and shit. They didn't know they were dead.
Maybe we should wait until 10? We wouldn't want to disturb them.
They'll be in the lab by 0700.
Not much we can do until then.
As Freeman took his communications device and left the conference room, I called Captain Cutter and asked him to join me. I did not know Cutter well, and I needed to find ways to distinguish him from other clones. In walked Captain Don Cutter. I pretended to recognize him, when in fact the only thing that stood out was the eagle on his collar.
What is the status of your ship?
We wouldn't do well in a fight, but she'll get us where we want to go.
Can she broadcast?
She broadcasted here.
Well, what happens if we find ourselves in a fight?
It depends who we're fighting, sir. As things stand now, the Churchill should do right well against transports and civilian ships.
How about UA battleships and carriers?
Permission to speak frankly, sir?
I wish you would.
The attack on Olympus Cree specked us up good. Our forward shield is fine, but our ass is exposed. If the enemy comes up behind us, we'll go down fast.
We had gone down to Olympus Cree to help the Unified Authority evacuate the planet. Then the bastards attacked us.
They specked us up good. Can you repair the rear shields?
They got the antenna, sir. We're going to need to build a new rear array.
I see. Has Lieutenant Mars had a look at it?
Well, he says he can fix her if we take her into the dry docks.
Thank you, Captain. You may take your leave.
Yes, sir.
All in all, the news could have been worse. We had a working ship and a way to communicate with Sweetwater and Breeze. Given a little time, Mars and his engineers might even get the spy ship operational. All just a matter of time. But we did not have time. Glad to have a moment to myself, I reviewed the situation in my head. The good news was that we had liberated the Golan dry docks from the Unified Authority, so we had facilities for repairing the Churchill. Fixing the spy ship was another story. Mars might be able to make her broadcast worthy if he got her to the dry docks, but the dry docks were thousands of light years away. We couldn't get her to the dry docks without broadcasting. And then there were the Avatari. Over the last 2 weeks, the bastards had attacked New Copenhagen, Olympus Cree, and Terrano. They were destroying planets every 3 or 4 days. Unless we stopped them, we'd be galactic nomads in another few months. I could not win this war. Yet I felt compelled to fight. We could attack and defeat the Unifieds, but they were more of a distraction than a problem. They had massacred our leadership while holding up a flag of truce, but we wouldn't make the mistake of trusting them again. If it came to a fight with the aliens, on the other hand, we didn't stand a chance. We couldn't even strike back at them if we wanted. How the spec do you defend planets from spontaneous combustion? If anyone could figure out a solution, it was Sweetwater and Breeze. Freeman was right. We needed them. Finding that communications computer was worth the risk, assuming they would be willing to help us. The last time I had spoken with them, they had not known that the Unified Authority and the Enlisted Man's Empire had gone to war. Hell, they didn't even know that the Enlisted Men had an empire. They thought we were loyal to the Unified Authority. I sat lost in my thoughts for maybe 15 minutes. The Avatari did not attack arbitrary targets. They went after the planets we had reclaimed after their first sweep through the galaxy. Once they finished attacking our planets, they would turn their sights on Earth. Sooner or later, we might need to evacuate the Unifieds from Earth along with the people living on our planets. Thinking about the situation made my head hurt. I sat and I stared and I rubbed my temples. Finally, I got up, still staring blankly ahead, and left the conference room. When I opened the door to my billet, I found Ava waiting for me.
How did you get in here?
A sailor let me in.
They're not supposed to let passengers into officers' quarters.
He thought you'd be glad to see me.
He was wrong.
I was lying.
Wason, I need to be with you.
You need to be with me? You moved on, remember?
Everything changed yesterday. I don't think I ever understood your world. Yesterday, it became real.
I don't see how that changes anything.
Wason, they killed my girls.
Well, go tell it to...
I don't love Kyle. I never did.
Ava stepped back into my orbit. She reached out and placed her hand against my chest. She might have been acting, or sincere, or possibly she was acting but thought she was sincere. I believed her. I did not know if she was my roommate or my girlfriend, but we spent the next few hours together. Location: Planet A361F. Galactic position: Solar System A361. Astronomic location: Bodis Galaxy. Only the captains of the four ships saw the video feed. Admiral Yamashiro would not risk showing it to anyone else. They met in a conference room on the command deck of the Sakura, Yamashiro's flagship. First, they watched the mission through Ilyich's eyes, video feed recorded by the camera in his visor. The captains saw the bleak landscape and the giant silos. They watched in silence as Ilyich scraped ice and analyzed it. A timer in the corner of the screen showed that the seals had been on the planet for 10 minutes and 17 seconds when the light appeared in the sky. Yamashiro stood at the front of the room.
Matsuda thinks the aliens detected the infiltration pods the moment they entered the atmosphere.
Matsuda Takashi ran fleet intelligence.
How could they have done that? We cannot track those pods. How would the aliens track them?
Yamashiro ignored Captain Yokoi Shigaru's question, and the video feed resumed. When Humble spun around to fire rounds at the silo, a small window appeared in a corner of the screen. The window showed the scene through the late Chief Petty Officer Humble's eyes as his bullets exploded against the silo's icy surface.
I wish he had tried a laser and a particle beam as well.
Takeda Gunpei was the only captain with an engineering background.
Good point. You should tell him if you see him.
They all knew that the seals did not return. But Miyamoto Genyo was a hard-ass, an old-style Japanese military man who never smiled and had no sympathy for weakness.
You may soon get your chance.
The feed showed the globe of light with creatures forming inside it and the ion curtain forming across the sky. The transmission ended, but the video feed continued. The screen showed the planet as seen from the stealth transport that launched the pods. The image on the screen looked like a barren planet partially dipped in white gold. They watched the shiny skin move across the atmosphere. A jolt ran across the planet, and the ion curtain dissolved, revealing a partially imploded planet. A flat and fiery dent showed on the otherwise iron-colored globe. With the planet's symmetry broken, it looked as though the stress of its own rotation might cause it to come apart.
The Kagai no Yasha detonated their ejector pods. I'm glad we gave them a traditional farewell.
So, we have destroyed an alien way station on an obscure planet. What have we learned?
We know they can detect the pods.
Takahashi Hironobu was captain of the Sakura. Takahashi was Yamashiro's son-in-law.
We have been searching their galaxy for nearly 3 years. Why has he taken the aliens so long to detect us?
They don't have a navy.
As the youngest of the ship's captains, Captain Yokoi generally remained quiet during staff meetings, but this time he spoke up.
Maybe they did not view us as a threat because we were in open space.
We have entered their solar system. They won't ignore us anymore.
If they detected the seals, they must know we are here as well.
That is a possibility. What do you suggest?
We must proceed with caution. They may attack at any time.
Two of the other captains, Yokoi and Takeda, agreed. Looking around the table, Takahashi could see it in their expressions and their posture. Takeda sat perfectly erect, an excited expression on his face. Captain Yokoi turned toward Takahashi and gave him a furtive nod.
Cautious, yes, but not timid like frightened mice.
Three of the four captains agreed, but democracy did not exist in the Japanese fleet. Admiral Yamashiro placed more weight on Miyamoto's opinion than the opinions of any other officer, and Yamashiro's decisions were the law.
We need to divide the fleet. If our ships travel as a pack, an attack on one ship could destroy us all.
Lone ships lose battles that fleets might win.
Having spent the last 3 years searching Bodis Galaxy, the Japanese sailors had no way of knowing that the Avatari had returned to the Milky Way. The last outdated intelligence they heard was that the Unified Authority had won the battle for New Copenhagen and the aliens had left the galaxy. They did not know that the Avatari had returned and incinerated New Copenhagen and Olympus Cree. They did not know that the Unified Authority had abandoned its military clones, and that the clones declared a civil war.
Now that we have destroyed A361F, the next closest planet is A361D.
What about A361E?
The name of the solar system was Bota Galaxy A361. A361F, the planet Ilyich and his seals destroyed, was the outermost planet in the system. A361E was the next planet in terms of distance from the center of the solar system.
It's on the opposite end of the solar system.
Admiral, why bother with the outer planets at all? We should bypass the outer planets and attack the planets closest to the star. The aliens will be on the planet that is the same distance from this star as Earth is from the sun.
That's quite a gamble, Captain Takeda. Why should we take such a risk?
When the aliens enter the Milky Way, they only attack the planets we ourselves would inhabit.
Miyamoto leaned forward so he could face Takeda, the old warhorse and the officer with the background in engineering. They were opposites and adversaries at every meeting.
The Avatari are miners, Takeda-san. They do not populate the planets. They conquer. They mine. Though a man would want to collect the content of a gold mine, he would not necessarily want to live in it. If we proceed to an inner planet, and they have bases on A361E or A361D, we could find ourselves attacked from every side.
All the more reason to split up the fleet. If we send one ship to each planet, we can search the solar system in a single day.
An excellent idea. We send one battleship to each of the remaining planets, and when one of them does not return, we will know where the aliens are hiding.
As the meeting ended, Yamashiro cornered Takeda Gunpei, the only one of the captains with a background in engineering. He fixed Takeda with a businesslike glare, and the two men sat silently as the other officers filed out of the room.
When that pod exploded, was it as powerful as a nuclear bomb?
It all depends on the size of the bomb. Judging by the damage, I would estimate that the explosion from the field resonance engine was 40 or 50 times more powerful than any nuclear explosion on record. But that is just a guess.
We have 5,000 of those vehicles aboard our ships.
There's no reason to worry about the pods, sir. They pose no more threat to your ships than the torpedoes in the armory. Maybe even less of a threat.
12 of them destroyed an entire planet.
The energy they produce destroyed the planet. The pods themselves are nothing more than a generator and a battery. When the battery is overcharged, it explodes. Without the charge, the battery is of little consequence.
Perhaps we should store them in our transports.
We do not have enough transports to carry 5,000 pods.
Yamashiro took in the information and nodded, all the while toying with the idea of dumping excess pods in space. Admiral Yamashiro did not often meet with SEALs. They were enlisted men. He was an officer. So many layers existed between them that he felt irritated that he now had to meet with Senior Chief Petty Officer Corey Oliver, the new leader of the SEALs. Yamashiro picked up the recon photos on his desk. Before approaching planets, the Japanese sent out stealth transports that deployed spy satellites. The images from A361D showed a barren planet with a brutal atmosphere. There were no military installations on planet A361D. In fact, there were no signs of any kind of development. The planet was a gas giant, its surface a bed of unrecognizable gases. Installations had been built, however, on the two moons orbiting A361D. One of the moons, designated A361D Satellite 1, had a long flat deck that might have been a landing strip. It measured 12.315 miles long and 12.298 miles across. It crossed a slightly raised plain that appeared to be made out of the same white substance as the soil around it. A361D Satellite 1 was a large moon, nearly 3,000 miles across, and had a thin but discernible atmosphere. The second moon, A361D Satellite 2, was 800 miles in diameter, considerably smaller than the moon orbiting Earth, with no atmosphere whatsoever. On this moon, the reconnaissance satellites found a ring of small buildings that looked like warehouses. They stood 20 feet tall, with flat roofs and no windows. With no wind to beat against them, and no elements to wear them down, the buildings were perfectly preserved. Without running more tests, intelligence had no methods for predicting the ages of the buildings. Looking at the bleak surfaces of the moons, Yamashiro wondered how the SEALs dealt with fear as they prepared for missions. They knew the risks. They were ugly and vicious, but they were also intelligent. Yamashiro admired their courage. The satellites had scanned for footprints, tire tracks, and landing points, and found nothing. If it were possible for buildings to spontaneously generate, he would have believed that the buildings on Satellite 2 had done just that. Yamashiro pressed the button on the intercom that connected him to his assistant.
Arakawa, please send the senior chief in.
The door opened, and Anna Arakawa, Yamashiro's assistant, showed the SEAL into the office.
I hope I did not keep you waiting too long.
No, sir.
They remained standing. Yamashiro knew that the SEAL would not sit down until given permission, and he enjoyed testing the clone's tolerance.
Would you like coffee or tea?
No, sir.
Yamashiro sat down.
Have a seat. The mission on A361F did not go as expected.
Were there casualties, sir?
There were no survivors. I will send you the video feed from the mission. Ilyich and his men performed honorably. Since he has not returned, I am promoting you to Master Chief Petty Officer, effective immediately. I have every confidence in your ability, Master Chief.
Thank you, sir.
I will also send you satellite photos of A361D.
Are there aliens on that planet, sir?
No, not on the planet. We have discovered structures on two of the moons. This mission should be similar to the mission on A361F.
The SEAL clone showed no reaction when he heard that they'd run an operation similar to the one in which his fellow SEALs had died. He sat still in his chair, his hands on his lap, his feet flat on the floor, his gaze not quite meeting Yamashiro's.
We will reach the moons in 20 hours. Prepare a reconnaissance team for the operation.
Yes, sir.
I want to send 100 men on this mission, 50 to each moon. Perhaps if we send a larger force, we will have better success against the enemy.
Yes, sir.
You may be wondering why we are sending men to these installations instead of attacking them from space.
No, sir.
No.
No, sir. I would not presume to question your orders.
Yamashiro believed this, but he still felt the need to explain.
As you will see from the video feed, Master Chief Ilyich destroyed A361F by detonating his stealth infiltration pods. We did not fire on that planet. Perhaps the Master Chief and his team would still be alive if we had. Ilyich and his men launched from a cloak transport, flying stealth infiltration pods. We did not know anything about the aliens' technology, but there is little chance they could trace the landing teams to our ships. If we fired on the planet, instead of sending a team, the aliens would certainly be aware of our ships. We have invaded an alien empire with 4 ships. We are badly outnumbered by an enemy with superior technology. If I must lose men to keep my ships hidden, I am willing to make that sacrifice.
Yes, sir.
Master Chief, as the highest-ranking member of the SEALs, you oversee the operation from this ship.
Sir, wouldn't that qualify as a dereliction of duty? As the highest-ranking man on the team, I am supposed to...
Master Chief, you'll be violating a direct order if you assign yourself to this mission.
Sir, if you are concerned for my welfare...
I do not have time to worry about your welfare. Sending your highest-ranking man into an action is inefficient. Commanding officers remain with the fleet and coordinate the movements. I was not aware that Ilyich accompanied the team to A361F. If I had been, I would not have allowed it.
Sir...
You have your orders.
Yes, sir.
Do you have any questions, Master Chief?
Yes, sir. Did Ilyich accomplish anything on A361F?
Yes. Yes, he showed us that detonating SIPs can destroy an entire planet. We learned that the aliens can detect our movements even when we cannot detect them ourselves. We learned that the aliens can detect us and defeat us from halfway across the solar system in 6 minutes.
Yamashiro kept these thoughts to himself.
We'll be in position by A361D in 20 hours, Master Chief. Have your men ready.
Yes, sir.
That will be all.
If Yamashiro did not want Oliver to show the video feed to all of his SEALs, he should have voiced his preference. The SEALs shared information unless given orders to conceal it. Oliver routed copies of the video feed to the senior chiefs on each of the four battleships, and they, in turn, held mass briefings in which they showed the footage to their men. Master Chief Oliver sat in the back of a large auditorium with his two closest friends, watching the video feed along with his men. No one in the auditorium spoke a word until the feed ended. When the lights came on, the SEALs divided themselves by platoon and discussed what they had seen. Oliver and his two friends, Senior Chief Jeff Harmer and Senior Chief Brad Warren, remained where they were.
What did you see?
We can't outgun them. It doesn't look like we can even touch them.
Agreed.
They only sent five defenders.
What's your point?
They must have had a pretty good idea about how many men we had, or they would have sent a larger force to intercept us.
Maybe they didn't have anyone else available.
Warren shook his head.
They always sent armies of 50,000 soldiers in New Copenhagen. It didn't matter how many men we sent, they always sent 50,000.
But if we caught them by surprise...
They could only find five men. Are you joking?
Okay, so you think they counted our caskets?
Aren't the caskets untraceable?
They are to us, with our technology. Who knows what they have? For all we know, they may be able to track us by our brainwaves.
How would you track an SIP?
Light field, vision, and sound tracking are out, but who's to say they don't have technology that senses every time anything breaches their atmosphere?
How in the world did you come up with that?
It's Occam's razor, yes, the simplest explanation. Their technology is more advanced than ours, but from what we know, it's centered around the use of tachyons and particles. Invisible or not, infiltration pods are still made out of matter. They still caused a physical disruption when they entered an atmosphere. Matter displaces matter, it's going to cause a disruption. The simplest solution is that the aliens counted the disruptions.
Tachyon early warning system, like a burglar alarm. How do we get around something like that?
Do either of you see any holes in the theory?
Neither of them did, so the discussion moved ahead.
They may have been bulletproof, but that final explosion did them in.
We don't know that. We know what it did to the planet, and we know that the tachyon curtain dissolved, but the alien avatars may have survived.
The avatars are made of tachyons. If the explosion dispersed the tachyons, then we can take it for granted that the individual avatars were destroyed.
That is the first time anyone has detonated a field resonance engine. We don't know how much radiation it generated. Maybe it was the radiation that destroyed the curtain.
But we all agree that the caskets did the job, right? I mean, come on, those babies zapped the whole planet.
They are our best weapon.
They may be our only weapon.
So do we win the war by blowing ourselves up?
We win the war by any available means.
Agreed.
Agreed.